Hello, and thank you for choosing this Analyst Insight podcast from the Information Security Forum. Hello to all those who are tuning in every couple of weeks to listen. You know why you are here. Are we surprising you, entertaining you, annoying you? Please let us know. mark.ward@securityforum.org is the address for any and all comments or suggestions for future topics. Or even if you want to be a guest, we're still on the lookout for that former lion tamer turned CISO or CISO turned lion tamer. We're not picky, to be honest. If this is your first time listening, welcome and buckle up. You may get more than you bargained for, but in a good way. In this episode, we turn again to AI. It's a subject we've covered a few times before, and this time I hope in a slightly different way. We're looking at how it might develop over the next few years, what that's going to do to us, for us, with us. And to be honest, one future development of AI I've already seen has given me a profoundly odd experience, but more on that shortly. My name is Mark Ward. I'm a senior research analyst at the ISF, and it occurs to me I've spent quite a lot of time in the company of AI through books, comics, movies, and intimate readings of various philosophical texts. But now it's intruding into the real world. I don't feel like that reading was really adequate preparation. Living it is very different to thinking it. But here to help me cope and to talk about AI is LJ Rich, a TV presenter, musician, hacker, many, many other things. And I can't think of anyone better to talk about this because LJ has messed around with AI, if that's the right term. And you're kind of one of those rare people who genuinely seems to live in the future, a few seconds, minutes ahead of us all. And yeah, just you're right there first. And full disclosure, she spent a lot of time working for BBC Tech Show Click. And at the BBC, that's where she and I were colleagues. Hello, LJ.
Well, hello there. What an amazing introduction. I live in the future. Nice to meet you all.
Yes, welcome. This is Earth. But I just got a quick question. Can you remember when you first found out about AI, the sort of idea or concept at all?
I mean, I've always been fascinated with technology since I was a child. I did electronic music when I was 12 at the Royal College of Music on a Saturday. I was just wanting to augment everything I could do with technology. And music is a very deep part of that. Creativity is a deep part of that. And as technology continues on its inevitable march to the future, AI or machine learning is basically incredibly advanced mathematics. And so as a result of that, it starts to have this mystique, I think, that if you start getting into it, becomes less of a mystery and more of a fascinating area. I think it was maybe 2017 that I was really wanting to play with AI. Yeah. I'd known about it for a little while, but I think I did my first kind of frustrated tutorial to try and understand how it worked back then. So I guess in AI terms, I am a veteran.
Yeah. Well, I say you've been there first. You're in that future. But also here, as a regular guest, Paul Watts, a distinguished analyst at the ISF, a former CISO, and to talk about the future, a man who has recently become a digital DJ. Hello, Paul. Are you spinning the wheels of steel, if people still say that? I have no idea.
Well, am I? It's harder than it looks, this DJing stuff. So yes, dear listener, I had a little bit of an existential midlife crisis and thought I'd give DJing a go. So I've gone out and I bought my controller and I've got my bits and the team are laughing hysterically at me and I'm giving it my best shot. And I'm giving it my best shot. It is harder than it looks, but you know what? Got to try these things, right?
Do you have a stage name? Are we going to see you on a billboard anywhere? On
DJ Gramps or something? I don't know.
Who knows? What music are you DJing with? Do you have a genre that you're playing with?
Yeah, well, so I've pretty much got the stabilizers on, and generally they say a good place to start is just good old-fashioned EDM, ideally with stuff that you know. It's all about knowing how to get in and get out of a track, you see. Yeah, early days. You know, would I branch out and try other stuff? I'd like to, definitely would like to. But baby steps, I think, LJ. You know, got to walk before I can run.
Get some AI music visualizer that you can then do some cool visuals with your tunes.
Yeah, here we come. AI stealing all our jobs.
Oh, not that old chestnut.
Well, I was going to ask, LJ, obviously you play the piano and a few other instruments, but I just wonder and you mentioned sort of technology and music being intertwined, but do you worry about what AI is going to do to that creativity aspect of this? Just is it going to take over? I mean, you said you use it to augment your performances, but yeah, is it a lot of the people worried about
it? I think, of course, the narrative that we're seeing everywhere is that AI is coming for all of our jobs and the likes of creativity and anything else is going to just disappear into the never-ending black hole that is AI stealing whatever it is that makes us feel like humans. I think that it, with a caveat, the sort of people who are using AI to generate music probably aren't going to pay somebody to compose a piece of music on commission.
Right.
And also right now, machine learning has quite a bit of difficulty writing something that's more than 30 seconds in length that sounds like music. There's recursion issues. There's other issues that are just as valid outside of music creation in AI as it is there. So there's a lot of issues to get over. And I think the more you start playing with AI and trying the tools out, you'll start to understand both the potential and the limitations of the technology. And so the idea of it taking our jobs becomes slightly more of a, okay, where are the areas that it can help us? Where are the areas that we can help each other? And then reminding ourselves that there is still a human at the beginning of all of these transactions, and the human can decide whether they work with an AI and take other humans out of the equation and therefore create something that's probably sufficient, bland, processed food. Yeah. Or you can use the AI to augment the human and create something more magical, in the same way that a person on their own doesn't sound as good as a person with a piano, which is a piece of technology that augments a person.
That's very true. Yeah, yeah. Well, you shouldn't forget that, should we? Just because it's not bits and bytes, then it's still technology in many respects. So, yeah, it has all kinds of forms. Yeah, because I think, I mean, certainly on the creativity side, there is that. I think you're right to say there's people find what they like, and I don't know that AI is going to change that necessarily, just because there will be artists that I like and doubtless they will use these types of tools to do the things that, you know, I like them to do. But I don't know that it's going to be a mass market. Well, I think there's going to be a lot of crap, to be honest. I'm not allowed to swear on this podcast if they're swearing. But there always has been.
In 2019, a few years ago, it took me weeks to understand how to write music with the help of an AI. I think there was one point where I spent 10 hours to make 45 seconds of music. And that's 10 hours overnight pressing a button every 20 minutes because I was doing a lot of the supervision in between the sort of 3 seconds of music. Do I like which one of the best three next seconds? Yeah. And it was excruciating. And yeah, lots of new words were invented during that. Now I can literally make 30 seconds of music in a few minutes just by typing text into something like Google's Music LM or Meta's open source Music Gen if I know enough about it. So I think it's just more people will have access to the technology. But this has always been possible to do with skill.
I still can't get to the point where I'm convinced that AI is going to replace artistic license. I think your point about it being a complementary skill set or capability is absolutely bang on. You know, someone like Ed Sheeran, who I've got a massive amount of time for, you know, a song pops into his head on a blustery Sunday morning and he's created a work of genius. And I can't see yet the point where a sentient AI entity is going to have that epiphany one day and write a classic. I just can't get myself to that point yet. But I think using it as a way to support, you know, we all get writer's block, artists get the same sort of creative blocks, and maybe, you know, that unblocking and helping you look at problems and look at compositions in a slightly different way, you know, to your point, LJ, I think that's where AI really has a spiritual home as a complementary tool. I just can't see it. So I'm going to replace Ed Sheeran, I think Ed is safe, mate. You're all good.
You're all good. But yeah, I think your point, LJ, about recursion as well is you know, I think that's, I've read a couple of academic studies which suggest if you feed that machine-generated stuff back into the machine, you don't get good results. And it goes weird really quickly. And I think that's definitely going to be a problem that needs to be confronted. But also as well, I think you only get more of what it knows when you use these types of tools at the moment. And I think you're right, Paul, they're not particularly creative. They give you what you know. And there's been some interesting cases of what that means potentially for copyright. But yeah, but it's not creative and different. And that's the human spark here. And I think that's a sort of, you know, what we're talking about. It's just that imprint of the human creative spark. Like I say, yeah, just making it sound different and coming up with something completely new.
At the end of the day, it's our consciousness, right? So it's basing it's basing its forward thinking on a cache of knowledge that it's gleaned over many years from multiple sources. You know, as we've talked about in our threat horizon research, you know, a lot of that can be based on, you know, unconscious biases. You could have errors in the data sets. There's all manner of things that could be conspiring to let those, well, essentially our algorithms, for want of a better expression, go off on a bit of a tangent. It takes you back to a fundamental basic of data processing. If you put garbage in, there's a high likelihood you're going to get garbage out.
Which is why a lot of the music generated by AI is in 4-4 time. It's in conventional, major or minor. You don't have as much world music put into the original database. So it means that you're never going to get these leaps. Like Mozart was obsessed with Turkish military band music. That's how we've got Alaturka, his famous song. And so as a result of that kind of rogue training data almost going into his model, we have a work of genius. And so I contend that if you do put more variety of data in, and at the moment, I think a lot of music models are based on, I think, 5,000 songs that have descriptions in, and we're at the mercy of the people who have originally created those descriptions. So what me and you would say would be fast might be different to somebody else. So there's some really interesting stuff going on in terms of text to music. But if we don't have enough data that's kind of gathered from all corners of the globe, as opposed to just 4-4 Western European tuning, then we're not going to come out with these strange, and like Bohemian Rhapsody, for example, or Queen, Bicycle Race by Queen was inspired by them recording in Montreux and a bunch of bikes from the Tour de France going past. And it's got a bicycle bell solo in the middle of it. I cannot see an AI going, hey, you know, it would be really great here. Let's put a bicycle solo in. Yeah.
Thanks, LG. That's going to be going around my head now all afternoon. I'll be humming it as I'm out for a walk.
I'm an earworm specialist.
But you've nailed it right there, right? You know, is AI going to have that moment in you're in a place, you're in an environment, a set of circumstances happens, you're in that moment and your creativity blossoms from that point. But the diversity of data, that is definitely something that's got a lot of legs. You know, if you are narrowing your cache of data, certainly for operational machine learning, Mark, and then you probably saw this in the research you've just finished, that there are some real dangers there in having that narrowness of mindset. And I think for creative and artistic work, LJ, I think you're bang on. You know, it's got to have a real spread, real spectrum of data to build its inferences on.
And you can still be inspired by it, I think. I mean, I know in the Threat Horizon 2024, we talk about dirty data, don't we? The whole idea of garbage in, garbage out. But it just becomes so interesting when you take creative examples and how that mirrors reality and society. And I think maybe that's what is interesting about it all.
To segue into Threat Horizon, thank you both for setting that up. The one of the reasons we chatted to LJ was that she was a guest presenter at the workshop we did back in July, I think it was, where we were exploring the methodologies that and the sort of approach we use to generate scenarios that populate Threat Horizon. And we asked LJ to explore AI, and that's where I had quite a strange experience, where LJ produced a digital version of me and got it to say a few things. And that was a profoundly strange, you know, cognitive dissonance right there. It was,
I cloned him.
Yeah. Yes. It was very odd, but
I would love to have seen that.
It was,
I think, with permission, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't,
you can't
just
do that without permission. He is called Mark II.
Of course. But I don't know. It was weird seeing yourself, you know, like, you know, Buzz Lightyear said, you know, am I really that fat? It was one of those weird experiences, because you never see yourself in from those kind of ways. I know you've talked, LJ, about seeing yourself in VR, and that was kind of a weird out-of-body type of experience, and it was certainly that kind of thing.
But it's like hearing yourself on voicemail.
Yeah. But the reason for doing that was just, I guess, to demonstrate how easy it is to use those kinds of tools and just where it might go. Are we all going to get digital doubles? Is that kind of where we might be going, do you think? Big question.
I mean, what, by choice or?
Well, I don't know, because I reason I suppose I asked that question is because thinking about this, reading around this a lot, one of the things that certainly ChatGPT is good at is mimicking human behavior. And you kind of think, if you were to sample everything your kids did, then you could get a convincing avatar of them by the time they were all sort of, well, pretty quickly, I think. And some of those futurists are talking about, well, that is going to become your digital version of you that inhabits whatever's out there in, you know, by the time those people get into the workplace. And I just wonder, is that likely? Do we want that? Is that the kind of thing? I don't know, Paul, if you were confronted by the digital you, what would you say to them? What would you, would that be a good thing?
No, not really. With it. Look, because I'm me, you know, I'm a child of the 70s. The experiences that I've had are all up here, the way I think and I feel, my conscious, unconscious biases, they're me. Why would I want to claim that? You know, it would be like, the thing is as well, is it was almost be like talking into a mirror and the mirror talking back to me. You know, why would I want to have a conversation with somebody with the same nuances, the same biases, the same personality? I just don't get where the benefit is. Now, funnily enough, ahead of this call, I had a little chat with Bard, because there are other chatbots available, and I said to Bard, look, Bard, you know, how would you feel if we created another version of you? You know, how would you feel about that? And Bard said, well, I think that would be a great idea to help understand the potential of AI, and it'd be a great way for me to learn about myself and my own capabilities and limitations. And I thought, but you're you. You already know all of this. Surely the thing that enriches us as a human species, the fact that we're all different, we bounce off each other, we come at things from different angles, we challenge and we accept challenge back. We aspire to be different, we aspire to be better. I just don't understand why a digital twin of myself basically saying the exact same thing in cyberspace. I'm not sold
well,
on it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, some of the characterizations of this have been, these things can go to your meetings for you and appear as if you were there. And it's like, well, why do I go to those meetings? I mean, it's just sort of...
I sit up with a drink in my hand whilst the
absolutely
goes to all my meetings and does team calls. Yeah. Bring it on. But I still don't think I still don't get how that benefits.
That's all it took, by the way, just the threat of going to a meeting or going to the pub and you've suddenly changed your view from, nope, not interested to, hang on a second, I can see the point in this.
Yeah.
I think the idea of having a proxy for your transactions makes some kind of sense. For example, if you programmed an AI with your food preferences and over the year it could work out, oh, the weather is 26 degrees Celsius and historically you've always gone for a salad at this time of day. So this is what I'm going to put in your shopping basket, and automatically, based on this representation, your digital twin, it could create something that's actually saving you time. Sure. However, I was lucky enough to have a chat with David Allen, who is one of the world's most well-known productivity experts, about what would happen if we could automate productivity. And he said, the thing is you could say, right, my energy level is 7, the sun's out, I could be doing any one of a number of tasks, but I still want to have a cup of tea or a beer in front of the TV. And that's the bit where it's the uncanny valley, I guess, between the digital optimized version of you that would buy the salad and the real version of you that would have a very large slice of lemon meringue pie.
I mean, the rebellious me would want to fight the system, because again, humans love to fight the system. So
yeah,
digital me thinks I'm going to have a salad. I would deliberately go out and buy a spaghetti bolognese. Just, but again, the way that you're talking about that, it's a supportive, the entity of my digital entity, my digital self, it's basically supporting me. It's not going off doing my bidding. So I think you're kind of back to what you said at the start, which is, I think the best use of this tech right now is really something that's complementary and supportive, rather than something that works in duplicity. I don't want the digital me going off and being me, because I want to control me. I want, do you know, I don't want to let go of that control yet. And maybe that's a nuance.
How about this? What if there was a way to say you're in a relationship, you record everything that happens in that relationship. So if there's ever a tricky moment, you can go back and say, no, actually, my dear, you said this.
No.
I mean, that'd be great, wouldn't it? That'd just solve all our relationship problems, wouldn't it?
Is this the, I think you'll find that, but you've automated it.
Exactly. That'd be...
Mark, you literally just destroyed 50% of the relationships on this planet. The whole ethos of saying, you definitely...
No misunderstandings.
You wanted a glass of red wine.
Actually, I think that if there was an opportunity to understand by somebody's tonality if they wanted support or advice, then that wouldn't be a useless thing.
Right.
And I suspect that, you know, sentiment analysis, emotion recognition, and the ability to, for example, understand how desperate somebody is where they're asking for a bank loan as the bank manager, then we're starting to enter some moral and ethical issues about how we pass the data that is innately human. So yes, these are really good questions that come out of these silly conversations.
Yeah. We're back to questions of bias here, because I think those sentiment analysis things, those emotion watching things are very good with certain skin colors. And you can imagine, you can guess which ones those are, because they reflect the biases of and the interests of, that's the word of the programmers that set them up. So I think, yeah, there's all kinds of other problems that start to emerge with that. But yeah, but at the moment, those algorithms seem to be about exaggerating in extremes, don't they? They're not about helping it. And I think that's definitely tricky, something that needs tackling, definitely.
I think there's a very big issue around technology, technological literacy, and the fear of technology as opposed to the desire to be educated on technology. And what I mean by that is, growing up, you're going to watch a children's TV show which has, say, adverts in and around it. The opportunity to have a discussion about the nature of those adverts, what they are, what they mean, why are they saying this? This person wants to sell you this particular snack, say. And why? Because they would like you to choose this snack as part of a lifestyle, or it's going to make you feel good. And having those conversations is difficult if you've not been given the tools to learn about how we as humans are manipulated in the real world, not just social media, but in reality. And that responsibility for looking after the people growing up with this unbelievable amount of information, it's so difficult.
Yeah, we can never put ourselves in the shoes, or walk in the footsteps of our children. And that information overload that we kind of quite flippantly talk about, how they are able to process all of that information, I just don't get how they can do that. So, you know, they're served a bit of left field content, and they don't really understand how that makes them feel, and don't really know what to do with that information or that knowledge, or know how to process it. What a terrible challenge for our young to face.
I think technology has always outpaced the regulations, people's ability to understand it and catch up with it as a whole. We are in this very strange situation, all of us, where we are able to watch technology trends evolve. Many people at the other end of the hype cycle are given a phone with a social media app on, and it feels good and interesting and engaging to play with. So that's a huge range of attitudes towards technology. And if you don't understand something, where is the incentive to learn more about it? And I think that's where people should be supported, given the opportunity to actually learn about it instead of just point from a distance.
Yeah, I think kids are, I think, more media savvy and literate than we think. I mean, certainly I feel quite lucky in that my two boys don't really engage much with social media. But I know they've got a lot of friends who do a lot of that. And certainly for my wife and myself, we've kind of weaned ourselves off doom scrolling because it was just affecting our mood and the way we viewed everything. And it's, you know, our lives are better because of that. But I'm aware that I've stepped out of the pool that everyone else is swimming in. And I just feel like maybe should be a better way to handle that. But it does feel like this is, one of the next podcasts we're doing is about social media, how that might change, and just, you know, different generations, how they use it. And it'd be interesting to hear just how people who are immersed in it utterly, so how different it is. I don't know about you, LJ. Do you use a lot of, I know you're on LinkedIn and various other places, but Twitter or anything like that, you use a lot?
I've got a very interesting relationship with social media in that I do use it for work, and I am able to interact with some very interesting people on social media. And I understand the values, the valuable aspects of social media. But at the same time, I see it almost like, if you're crossing a road, you need to know to look left and right. You need to be able to avoid anything that looks like it's going to hurt you. And as a result of that, my forays into social media, I tend to try very hard to avoid content that I would find distressing. And I think it's a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, it can connect people, give support to so many. If someone is lonely, they've got an opportunity to interact with people who are a bit more like them, maybe not speaking in the mirror. But then at the same time, it's obviously not great to look at a bunch of unrealistic images and base your sense of self upon them. So I think, yeah, I do use it, but not to the sort of extent that I'm missing out on other things.
No, I think, yeah. I think
it's complicated.
Yeah, I think a healthy way to do it. It's just that, because like you say as well, nothing comes raw through social media. It's all filtered and all processed and all, you know, you get what it thinks you should be looking at. It's not just, you know, it's not a window on the world. Mm. It's a very warped kind of view of things. I don't know, Paul, are you a big social media user?
I used to be. Obviously, LinkedIn professionally is something that I engage with, but I think that's a slightly different... Although some of the behaviours on there sometimes can be quite suspect.
Have you seen the state of LinkedIn, by the way?
Yes.
There was one that said, it's a parody account which tweets versions of LinkedIn, like super tech kind of, you know, I've written my book from witching hour to pitching hour. It's things like that. It's hilariously
So I'll tell you a story. This is a little bit just on that, the state of LinkedIn. So I featured on there once.
Did you?
Completely accidentally. So what happened was my daughter left her laptop unlocked and logged in, and this was at a time when the kids were all doing Discord, and I constantly, as everyone in my family will attest to, I'm constantly talking about the importance of being situationally aware and, you know, not necessarily trusting your environments, bloody, bloody, blah. Anyway, she was out with her friends. And so I thought I'd just start talking to them on this Discord server. And there was this blind panic where actually she then said, "Dad, what are you doing?" And she came back to the house at breakneck speed to log herself back out. But what was interesting then is the kids all started engaging with me, saying, "Oh, you know, well, is it really that easy, you know? And what should you do?" And we ended up having a bit of an AMA about, you know, passwords and 2FA and all that and the other. I thought, just because it was an impromptu thing and we were doing a lot on security culture at the time, I just dropped it as a gambit on LinkedIn and it got a huge amount of engagement. And then somebody said, "You might want to have a look at the state of LinkedIn account." And it posted on there, and I was like,
fabulous.
This is just happening. I mean, obviously I ignored it and just kind of laughed it off, but it was just one of those stories that just seemed completely unrealistic actually happened.
Yeah.
got me nailed on the site of LinkedIn. Very embarrassing. But
was that the first time she'd left the computer unlocked and open like that?
And the last time, hopefully.
Because it's quite harsh if you just decided to jump on the first time.
No. It was No, she'd done it a few times, and there'd actually been a couple of challenges with her accounts being taken over as well. So it was just an opportunistic thing. I do a lot of work with school governance. So the primary school that her and her friends went through, I know a lot of the children there quite well. You know, I've watched them all grow up, and they so it was just kind of done in the moment. There's a little bit of amusement, but the fact that they were all really interested and suddenly asked questions. Mm. One of the fundamental principles I apply when I talk about security culture and security awareness is make it personal. So the fact that they were interested and they were concerned and they had questions, I thought, this is worth 10 minutes of my time. And so I did. And she came back and yelled at me and kind of like message received. But, you know, sharing that story and finding myself going on there. Was
almost
like
a meme. You're almost a meme.
I think you should print it out and frame it.
No.
You've arrived.
No.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. Well, just some closing thoughts and sort of to wrap up this as well. LJ, I don't know if your son, if you restrict his social media technology use at all, but I suppose the broad question is, are the kids going to be all right, do you think? Is technology going to do good things to them, with them, for them? Big question.
Oh, it is a big question. I mean, he's only little, so he doesn't have a social media presence. And knowing what I know about technology, I think that he needs to understand what he's getting into. And once he and I can have those sorts of conversations, then it's going to be a lot easier for him to navigate, because he'll enter with an understanding based on experience, as opposed to being left unsupervised on YouTube for any one of a number of hours. Mm. In terms of whether we should fear the future, I've written in my notes, if you can simulate sincerity and kindness, is that as good as the real thing?
Basically on outcomes. Yeah, definitely. I would say if you can fake sincerity, you're golden, I think. Yeah. So now, what about you, Paul? Are you, do you fear for the future? Are you, the kids all right? If people say that anymore.
Well, I've made a career out of fearing for the future, so maybe I'm a little bit tight in terms of saying this. I think the children of the next generation will be okay. I think what we have to remember is that we preside over a transitional period in the evolution of technology, where we see the remnants of the analog world and we see the potential of the digital world. And we're kind of sat in between trying to make sense of both of that. And a good kind of analogy of that is the challenges of what you do in social media, for example, and being situationally aware. Mm. The older generation have a similar challenge and a similar problem, and we often forget about the fact that we're digitizing pretty much everything that moves, and we're abandoning the senior citizens who are trying to find their way as well. So we are kind of the meat in a sandwich, if you like. The kind of that old and young generation are the ones that are kind of trying to find their way with it, and we're kind of stuck in the middle, seeing both sides of the coin. My ask, and I say this a lot and I bring it up a lot, is we need to educate our children to be situationally aware in a digital and analog world. We're very, very good at teaching them to look both ways when they cross the world, to never talk to strangers and all this stuff in the analog world. But we now have to recognize that, you know, to the point we made earlier, they now essentially have to worry about two personas, their digital self and their analog self. And they need to be equipped to understand the pros and cons and the ramifications of how they look after both. They also need to be equipped with the ability to critique and challenge and not believe everything the computer says. It's very, very easy to misdirect and misinform people, and picking the first search result out of Google or relying on Bard or ChatGPT or anything else to provide social and moral and ethical cues is just not the right approach. And we need to make sure that children are equipped to process what it is being thrown at them on a day-to-day basis. So I think they'll be okay. We have to recognize that they're starting from a very different position than we are. And I think you said it yourself, Mark, they're more capable and more robust than we probably give them credit for, but a little bit of hand-holding would not go amiss, I think.
Especially as AI can generate so much activity and content, disinformation, spam. If you have even a sense of what you're reading might not be true, that's a really good start.
Yeah, it's a good skill to develop, I think. So perhaps we shouldn't fear the future. Maybe we'll build a bunker. Not sure. But I, for one, welcome our new robot overlords. Many thanks, everyone, for listening. Tell your friends. Tell your enemies. Why should you have all the fun? You can now find ISF podcasts on all major podcast platforms. Look for our page on Audioboom, where you can subscribe to make sure you don't miss an episode. And who would want to do that? The podcasts are also available at securityforum.org, where you can also learn much more about ISF research, tools, and guidance.